Welcome to Richard Hoagland's The Other Side of Midnight. So this is a beautiful evening on the East Coast and the West Coast. We're enjoying beautiful weather. And regretfully, Richard cannot join us tonight. He sends his best to all of you. I'm very excited with the guest we have tonight is Christopher Loring Knowles. He's a featured guest on our show many times, and he's bringing new information that'll just rock your socks off. The show tonight is called Disclosure and Apocalypse are synonyms. So if you want to find the show page, you'll go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on that banner. Disclosure and Apocalypse are synonyms, and it will take you to the show page. So Christopher is, as I mentioned, a frequent guest, and he is the author of The Secret Sun. Christopher Loring Knowles is the author of The Eagle Awarding Our Gods Wear Spandex, The Secret History of Comic Book Heroes, co-author of The Complete X-Files Behind the Series, The Myths and the Movies, and The Secret History of Rock and Roll, The Mysterious Roots of Modern Music. He was an associate editor and columnist for the five-time Eisner Award-winning comic book artist magazine, as well as a writer and reviewer for the UK magazine Classic Rock. He's appeared on ABC's 2020 and VH1's Metal Evolution, and several radio shows, including Man Cow in the Morning, National Public Radio, and The Voice of America. He has appeared in several documentaries, such as Wonder Woman, Daughter of Myth and the Man, The Myth Superman. He was invited to lecture on science fiction, mysticism, and mythology at the legendary Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California in 2008 and 2009. And he blogs regularly on The Secret Sun. Welcome, Chris. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I know. I was just so excited when I was putting up your page to see the items that you've lined up for us. It's going to be an amazing background as far as the background and also what's going on currently. So would you like to start off with our current situation, or do you want to go back in time? What's your preference?
Well, let's start what's going on now. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners will probably be familiar with the ongoing disclosure process that seems to be emanating from the United States Navy in particular. And we can go into a little bit of that. I think it's sort of revealing that the United States Navy is probably the most powerful force, not just military force, but economic and political force in the world at this moment. And I think that what we're seeing with the Navy has a lot to do with the challenge being posed by China. And China is trying to build its own blue water navy to regain control of the China Sea and the Indian Ocean. And I think this, you know, the backdrop here is very interesting. I mean, the various streams and currents running through this whole process are fascinating, coming from a very unlikely source in the person of Tom DeLonge, former guitarist and songwriter for a punk band called Blink-182, currently in a rock band called Angels and Airwaves, and had sort of gotten in touch with a lot of people, interesting people, Hal Puthoff, Christopher Mellon, Luis Elizondo, a number of different people from military and intelligence who approached him and knew that he was interested in UFOs and knew he had an abiding interest in study in the subject, and for some reason chose him to be the front man for this, what's called the To the Stars Academy, and which is really behind a lot of these stories that we're seeing in the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on and so forth. So we're really a very unlikely source for, you know, what is a world-changing project, I think.
I'm curious, how do we know that they went to him? I mean, is it because of the work he's doing, or there's actually some kind of information saying that they reached out to him?
Well, he had made the claim, and the claim was later verified by a number of different sources.
I see.
So, you know, and Christopher Mellon is a scion of the Mellon family, the well-known dynasty, Mellon dynasty, which is a very interesting source for his involvement. But he was involved in all sorts of interesting military and intelligence and high-ranking governmental work. So we're really dealing with a very interesting and powerful staff of individuals that are involved with, you know, a person who could, you know, if you were uncharitable, could be considered a has-been rock star. And interestingly enough, I mean, you know, so Tom DeLonge was sort of, you know, the front man for this process, and it appeared on a very well-known and popular web show and podcast called The Joe Rogan Experience. And he did extremely badly.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So since then, this gentleman called Luis Elizondo has sort of taken his place as the publicity force.
And what is Luis? Is he a musician as well?
No, he's intelligence, CIA, Pentagon, you know, pretty straight ahead intelligence operative. And the interesting thing is that there's been a great deal of controversy over his involvement in this program, which is has a name that I will not try to mangle, but it was also known as the ATIP program, which has to do with, you know, anomalous aircraft. So, you know, basically what we've been seeing for some time now, and the process seems to really have kicked up again, is the United States Navy, without which the world economy as we know it would cease to exist, incidentally. This phenomenally powerful organization, basically releasing a number of different accounts of pilots. You know, interestingly enough, I mean, the Navy Air Force is probably as powerful, if not more so, than the United States Air Force.
Really? I had no idea.
Yeah, oh, yeah. We can get into that later on, because it ties into some of these personages that seem to weave in and out of all these stories. So the Navy has been releasing a lot of accounts of pilots, jet pilots, fighter pilots, who have been encountering and sort of been stymied by these odd objects. And there was the famous Tic Tac video where this object that had apparently been sighted for a number of days, flying at enormous rates of speed, and I guess harrying or menacing these pilots and these aircraft carriers, and so on and so forth. You know, that video was released in 2017, and we can get into that because that's a very interesting coincidence there. But also that, you know, we're in a situation where, you know, with the so-called Nimitz incident, which involved the Nimitz carrier group in Southern California and Baja California in Mexico, but also a number of accounts emanating from a totally different carrier group off the East Coast, Central East Coast of the United States, you know, around Virginia and so on and so forth. So it's a very strange and interesting process where the military for 70-plus years has denied the existence of UFOs and denied that they've ever encountered any kind of unexplainable or anomalous aircraft is suddenly being very forthcoming about this. And the interesting thing is that the way they're rolling it out, I mean, it's an interesting process that I know Richard has talked about, you know, vis-a-vis the Brookings Institute. Mm-hmm. And their recommendations for acclimating people to UFOs and so on, that I think we're seeing a continuation of the, I think we're seeing the next phase. So basically what we had starting in the late 40s was a process in which science fiction films and contactees and all these kind of sources that people would not necessarily take very seriously were bombarding the mass media. And this is a process that lasted for decades up until fairly recently. And with all sorts of science fiction films and, you know, X-Files, of course, and Outer Limits and The Invaders and all kinds of, you know, shows like Falling Skies and a lot of these sort of UFO colonization narratives on cable channels and so on. So we seem to be at the end of that process. And I think that acclimatization process is sort of almost peaked in 2009, 2010 or so. We just saw this avalanche of not very memorable or very quality UFO and abduction movies and cartoons and so on. And now it seems to be the next part of the process. And I think what we've seen, and I think this is the desired intent, is that there almost seems to be among a lot of people who don't really consider the implications of all this, it seems to be almost like an apathy or a, I don't know, I don't want to say necessarily a disbelief, but just like, oh, well, you know, I think we've had a generation of kids, an entire generation now, that have grown up seeing not only UFO and alien narratives in popular culture, but have seen thousands, if not tens of thousands, of UFO videos on YouTube and the internet.
Right,
you know
right.
What I'm saying? And I think, you know, contrary to what people say, I think that the process where you can go onto YouTube, and it's interesting, you know, I told you that I had a computer crash, and when I was going through my backups, I was trying to, you know, delete a lot of files and so on, and I was looking through, you know, a tube program that I have that saves YouTube, and I had hundreds and hundreds of these, what I consider genuine UFO sightings on film. Oh. And they're mm-hmm. so common that, I mean, of course, there are lots of silly CGI fakes and so on and just kind of nonsense. But there are just so many UFO videos online that it just becomes like, yeah, I get the picture.
But right, you know,
interestingly enough, I had my family and I, starting in 2015 and starting with my son, had a little UFO flap of our own. My son worked at a very posh and upscale golf course here in New Jersey, and he and his friends, you know, they were packing up for the night and just saw these three UFOs hovering over the woods, and they hovered there, and it was they took videos and so on of these things on their phones. And, you know, of course, it's very difficult to take pictures of something in the sky with your phone, especially when it's
yes.
dark. But, you know, you see it well enough. And, you know, the UFOs were there so long that they got tired of it and just left. You know, they're just like,
oh, my
okay.
gosh. Yeah.
And then,
well, I know.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just add that the young people I know, they just take it as a given. Of course there are UFOs. I mean, they don't even question it anymore.
Well, I think that's the process that I know Richard has spoken about at length, that I think it's the process of acclimatizing people to this reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I'm curious about is, you know, they've been using the film industry to introduce the idea that, in fact, they really are out there. And like some of them are so negative, like The Alien. And then you have others like, of course, Star Trek or The Arrival, that recent one.
Mm-hmm.
And are you noticing a trend leaning more one way or the other, or are they just like presenting both sides?
Well, I got to tell you something. You'll hear about movies like Aliens or The Arrival, but there are tons and tons and tons. If you have Amazon Prime and use Amazon Prime Video, just tons of independent and low budget films on UFOs and aliens and so on. So much so that it kind of boggles your mind, because there seems to be this entire genre that escapes the mainstream's notice, but these films just keep getting made. And a lot of them, you know, are very interesting films. I mean, you know, they're obviously low budget films, but some of them are very interesting, but it's almost impossible given the volume of these films to determine any kind of trend lines, because there's so much of it, and there's so many viewpoints on offer that you can't really get a sense of where the thinking is. I think it's just you know, it's just very difficult to do so. But getting back to what I was saying about the UFO, so back in, I guess, 2015, 2016, we were driving up to New Hampshire to visit my my grandmother, because she was having her 100th birthday party. And oddly enough, we were driving through the town that one of these Navy pilots who have, well-known Navy pilots now, who are in the media all the time, the town that he lives in. And it's fascinating to me, because this gentleman is from Ohio, but he lives in this area of New Hampshire, which is quite the UFO hotspot. And if you go online, go on YouTube and just, you know, New Hampshire, you know, Salem, New Hampshire, you know, that UFOs, orbs, you know, particularly orbs in this case, that you're going to find, you know, dozens of videos. And I find it fascinating that this gentleman is living in that area. And this is also the area that's right near what's called America's Stonehenge, which is another interesting aspect to this, because a ritual seems to be tied up in this very tightly. And I think that's something that, you know, would kind of confuse people like the late, great Stanton Friedman, or any kind of, you know, I guess more today, somebody like Richard Dolan, but people who are more nuts and bolts oriented would overlook the vast and complex and multivaried ritual aspect to this, and how much the occult plays in this. But be that as it may, I mean, so we were coming up Route 93, which would, you know, ultimately, if we kept on, it would take us to where the Betty and Barney Hill abduction took place up in Indian Head. But so we're coming in, and we see this plane taking off from Manchester Airport, and it was, you know, it was pretty low. I mean, it probably was maybe 1,000 feet up in the air, maybe less, maybe 500 or 600 feet. And we see these two orange orbs that were like, you know, bird dogging it. They were like flying around it. And I was like, are they trying to make that plane crash? And, you know, so they're sort of flying around this plane. I don't even know if the pilot actually even noticed it. And then they sort of did that as, you know, the plane sort of came near our position. And then they flew directly over our car. You know, we were just watching these orange orbs just like fly right over the car. And it's like, you think like, oh, well, you know, you probably hear 100 stories like that, and people with there are some kind of misidentification. But like I said, you can go online and see videos of these things. I mean, they're actually so common that people don't even pay attention to them anymore.
Well, I've been so curious. Is there a sense of scale when you were looking at them so close? Did you have any sense of scale what size these orbs were? I mean, are they like the size of the craft that they were flying around, or bigger or smaller, or?
Well, I guess in relation to the craft, in relation to the cockpit, I would imagine that they would have been maybe about 5 or 6 feet in diameter, maybe more.
Uh-huh.
maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 feet.
I mean, not very big. Not big at all.
They were like the size of almost like, you know, they almost look like basketballs, you know, but you know, making adjustments and allowances for the distance, I would have said that they were probably maybe about 10 feet in diameter at the most, and, and maybe 5 at the least. I mean, they were not excessively large.
So it makes me think either they're remote control, or there are one or two beings in there, or they're super small beings. They're more, you know, I mean, like, because, I mean, how many people or beings could you fit in such a small craft? I mean, well, there's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are beings. I think that, I don't think they're craft. I think that they're beings. I think that.
Oh, you think the orb is the being?
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Oh.
The one thing that I really got a sense of when I saw it is that they were intelligent. And they were reacting to the, this flight of this plane in an intelligent manner. And I thought somewhat menacing manner in some regard. Maybe just like almost like a trickster kind of thing. But they were translucent. They were not opaque.
Because I've also heard the suggestion that they could be like Earth diva spirits, like, you know, multidimensional beings.
Yeah, I think that's entirely possible. But like the most recent sighting that we had was a and this is an interesting story, because this sort of ties into what a lot of people who studied this phenomenon for a long time will say. You know, people, you know, particularly I'm thinking of people like Jean Kiel and Jacques Vallée and Amy Michel, people who sort of took a more I don't want to say supernatural, but, you know, there's some aspect to this phenomenon that does not work the way you would expect metal craft from a distant planet coming here to monitor us for some reason or another. Because, so I'll just give you a little bit of background. One night I was working, and while I was working, I had a documentary, a Netflix documentary on. You know, I was just sort of listening to it while I was working. It's a movie called The Man Who Sees UFOs, I think it's called. And it's about this guy down in Monterey, California, who's taken hundreds of videos, predominantly of orbs, hundreds if not thousands of video over the past several decades, and just seems to have this ability to intuit when these craft or objects or whatever you choose to describe them as would be in the area. So I watched this film, and I was, you know, it was after midnight, and I was going to take the dogs out, and I was just thinking about, like, you know, because I've been to Monterey and, you know, familiar with the area, and I was just sort of thinking, you know, like, there's been a lot of UFO activity going back to Spanish colonization days. You know, there's a very famous a mission near Big Sur that has a lot of activity noted for several centuries. And I was just sort of thinking about the placement and all this sort of thing like that. So I'm taking the dogs out and they're, you know, waiting to do their business. And I look up in the sky and I see what, you know, looks like a plane. And it looked rather low. It looked, you know, it looked a bit low for a plane. And it comes out of the cloud cover, and then it stops. I'm like,
what?
Okay, yeah, planes don't stop.
Yeah, no, not at all.
And what I realized is that it was a chevron-shaped UFO. And I just looked at it for a while because I was just like, is that what I think it is? And I went inside and I got my glasses, you know, because I just thought, well, maybe I'm just, you know, misperceiving something. And I'm looking at it with my glasses, and then I get the, you know, not great set of binoculars out, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, that's a Chevron UFO. That's a classic Chevron UFO.
Is that the one posted on the page?
Yes.
Is that the one? Yeah, okay, it's number 8. If
yes.
Anyone wants to see, it's number 8 on the page. Yes.
So, that sat there for a very long time. And, after a while, I called my wife out, and she took pictures of it, and again, it's very difficult to take pictures of a distant object in the sky at night. But she got, I think, a couple of pretty impressive images of it. Mm-hmm. And we just watched it for, and it was incredibly bright, and it was below the cloud cover, which is, you know, the clouds, it sort of came in, and I looked at the ceiling that night, and I think the cloud ceiling was maybe like 3,000 feet, something like that. So the cloud ceiling was rather low, and this thing was beneath the cloud cover, as you can see in one of the photos. Mm-hmm. And we just watched it for a long time, and then, like, you know, my daughter got up, and we, you know, we told her to come out and look at this thing with us. And the pictures don't really do it justice, because it was very bright. And but it was, again, that classic Chevron UFO. And the interesting thing is that not long after, a couple months after, that there were sightings of this these objects all over the country. There was one down in Austin, Texas, and I believe in Colorado, and also in California. So there were these objects showing up in the western half of the country as well. And you know, we sat there and we watched this thing for a very long time. It was really interesting.
My goodness.
And it was making these weird movements, because it was moving in like an almost like an L shape. It would move vertically, and then it would lower, and then it would move into the distance. So it would move.
Is there anything in your area that you think it would have been observing that would have been of interest to it where you live?
I have no idea, but you know, I don't know. It's very hard to say. Uh-huh. You know, this area is very the area I live in is very strange. There's a lot of strange things that occur around here. Back in 2010, I had had a I was taking the dog for a walk at night. It was late at night, and we both sort of stopped because this luminous figure stepped out of the woods. It was about 4 feet tall, and seemed to be featureless, and stood in our path. You know, we would have, you know, down the street. It was maybe about 200 feet down the road, maybe 150 feet, and just stood there. And it's interesting because my dog is a collie, and I don't know if you know about collies, but they're very barky, and she's a very barky dog. And she sat there, and she was just transfixed by this thing. She was just like, what is that? You know, if it was a person, uh-huh. Of course it was auto luminous, but now this is getting back to what I'm talking about. So that, you know, as soon as I saw that object, I went back home and I got on Facebook and I was like, I think I saw a ghost or something, you know, and then started this huge thread with all these people asking me about it and stuff. But the next day I had driven down that street. And when I went to the end of the street, there was one of those big sort of traffic LED signs, you know, that the traffic uh-huh. department put up. And it was saying, you know, the message was that someone had been hit in a hit-and-run accident at that spot. And, you know, if you know anything about it, to call the police and so on and so forth. So I just thought it was interesting that, you know, I see this object and the next day, it turns out that there'd been a hit-and-run accident, you know, at the end of that street. And that, to me, is like, you know, there's something else going on. There's something else.
You think in some way it's related?
I couldn't help but think it was related, yeah. It seemed to me to be too much of a coincidence because, you know, I've read accounts of people go ahead.
Yeah, let's hold that thought because we're coming up on the break right now. You're listening to The Other Side of Midnight. The show tonight is Disclosure and Apocalypse, Our Synonyms, and our wonderful guest is Christopher Loring Knowles. And we shall return. We'll be right back.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoglund and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Welcome back to Richard C. Hoagland's The Other Side of Midnight. Our guest tonight is Christopher Loring Knowles, and the show is Disclosure and Apocalypse Are Synonyms. So let's pick up on that story you were telling us about, Chris. It was the orbs that were going around the thing, and then you went down there and you saw that there had been an accident.
Oh, right. No, that was that wasn't an orb. That was a luminous figure, four foot tall, you know, which I've read about in other books. I mean, I remember that reading a very chilling account of a gentleman in Scotland who had encountered one of these beings and decided to like chase it and came down with a radiation poisoning. So there's a number of these stories, and the interesting thing is that, you know, I went through most of my life without having any of these kind of experiences, and then they all sort of happened in a cluster, and I often wonder why exactly that is. I mean, they're not things that I spend a lot of time really thinking about. You know, I recorded them and I documented them as best I could. But it just seems to me that it just seems a bit weird that, you know, these kind of occurrences would happen in a cluster after, you know, having only a couple of very brief and fleeting and largely ambiguous sightings, you know, earlier in my life. But, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with things that we don't necessarily take account when we talk about the subject. And like I said, I mean, I don't believe that this is a technology that we could even recognize as a technology. I think we're looking at something that is truly alien, is truly unknowable. Like, this is why I don't pay a lot of attention to like crashed saucer stories and so on like that. I mean, it just seems to me that like, seeing these objects in the sky, you kind of get the sense that you're looking at something that does not make sense in our physical world, and specifically under our physics. You know, for instance, the Chevron UFO, which I said I saw video of identical objects on YouTube, and I recommend that anyone who's interested in this go on and look at these objects yourself.
Wasn't that like the same shape that appeared in the Phoenix Lights, where there was
No, that was a triangle.
Okay.
I could be mistaken, but when you look at the object that I saw and the objects that other people were fortunate enough to have filmed, that it doesn't make any aerodynamic sense at all. It's, you know, it's a V shaped with these huge lights. That you know, there were six. I believe there were six lights on the you know, the wing. You know, it's basically a flying.
Right.
And I'll tell you something. I did a lot of research because I was saying, you know, some people were saying this was a drone, or this was some sort of, you know, because I'm not that far from McGuire Air Force Base. McGuire Air Force Base is probably maybe 2.5 hour drive from here. So, you know, airtime, that would be much shorter.
Nothing,
Yeah, but I just could not find anything even remotely like this object online. And you know, mind you, I'm not saying, I mean, this Chevron object could well be some sort of highly advanced aircraft, but I couldn't understand the construction of it and why you would have an object, what aerodynamic purpose these enormous lights that take up the lion's share of the surface of the underside of the V shape, what possibly you would choose to do that. I mean, you can have extremely luminous lights on any kind of aircraft and have them be rather small, especially these days. I mean, you can create a very bright light with very small bulbs, essentially. So,
but maybe it wasn't for lighting. Maybe that surface area is for somehow creating energy. Maybe it's part of the propulsion.
It's entirely possible, too. I mean, maybe those lights are not lights. They're some sort of highly advanced
plasma. Keith is saying plasma in the chat window.
It's entirely, I mean, the thing is that, you know, when I was looking, and like I said, this object was rather low. I would say it was maybe 2,000 feet in the air, maybe even lower. So that's not even a mile.
I'm also curious about that, the Chevron that you saw. Are you saying that you could see sky behind it so that it actually was a Chevron and not a triangle?
Yes.
Just in the dark? Yeah. Okay.
And if you look at the photos, one of the photos, again, it's very hard to take pictures of an object at night without professional equipment, and my wife was just using a normal digital camera. But and if you look at again number 8 picture on pictures radio with pictures, you can see that the construction of the object very clearly, which is remarkable to me, you know, given the distance and the lighting. But
and there also seems to be like a light on this. I mean, there's the chevron shape, and then I'm talking about the close-up on the right-hand side. Then there seems to be a light that doesn't seem consistent with that chevron pattern. It's like an extra light.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That big one at the bottom.
I think that's probably a bit of camera blur. But, you know, it's entirely possible. I mean, this thing was bright. And it was really, I've never seen anything in the sky this bright in my life.
Mm-hmm. It looks really bright, even in the small view, where it's very small on the image. It's as bright as the moon. It looks enormous, actually.
And look at the cloud cover. Look how it's beneath the cloud cover. So it's not you know, some sort of celestial object that we were misidentifying. So I don't know. You know, it was very unusual. But I think, getting back to what we're talking about as far as disclosure, I think what's going on is that, again, it's this acclimatization process that so many people have seen, like X amount of movies, E.T., Close Encounters, so on and so forth. And enough people now have either seen these objects in the sky or have seen YouTube videos of them that I think it's sort of like, okay, now we can up the ante a bit. Now we can go to the next stage of the process. You know, we can go to the next phase of the program, essentially, is I think what's going on. And I think that, you know, the way it's being rolled out is very interesting, because there's almost like a sense of plausible deniability. You know, who is this Luis Elizondo guy? You know, was he really an intelligence operative, or, you know, is he just blowing smoke? Was he really involved in this program, or is he just some sort of pencil pusher who was just doing something totally unrelated? But that's always how these things go. It's always rolled out with a sense of that they can always pull back if they have to. But go ahead.
So with this rolling out and the Navy's announcing they're seeing this UFO and that UFO, they're just like not addressing the fact that all these years they've been saying, no, there isn't any. There aren't any. Now suddenly they, you know, they don't even address the contradiction. Maybe they think people have forgotten that they were saying no.
Well, I'll tell you something. It always makes me wonder, because the Navy, and we can get into this, because the Navy has played a very strange game with this topic. A lot of the responsibility for investigating UFOs has been kicked over to the Air Force, right? Blue Book, Grudge, Twinkle, all these different programs that sort of ended with the Condon Report in the late 60s. But the Air Force is very much the junior partner in the military industrial echelon. You know, the Navy is the top dog. The Navy rules the roost. The Navy is very interesting, because a lot of people will look at the Army and the Marines, and, you know, particularly the Army, because the Army is so huge, and not really pay attention to the power and the equipment and the scope and the reach that the United States Navy has. And the United States Navy is the most powerful military force in human history.
I had no idea.
Absolutely, yeah. There's nothing even second. There's not even a close second in the annals of history. The United States Navy is their strength and their power and their reach, which is, you know, important in this regard, is unprecedented. But what we saw with the UFO flaps with Kenneth Arnold and Roswell in the late 40s is that the Navy took a much different tack than the other branches of the service. I mean, you didn't really have the Air Force until a bit later, because it was still the Army Air Force. The Air Force was still a branch of the, or a sub-branch of the United States Army. But you had a lot of very powerful and interesting military personnel in the Navy who were directly involved in this, and particularly a organization that a lot of your listeners will probably be familiar with, and that's an organization called NICAP. And NICAP was one of the earliest and probably the most impressive of the major UFO research organizations, of which I think the only one active and still considerable, it would be MUFON. But NICAP was a totally different thing altogether, because NICAP had military people involved in it, and it had people who were involved with the military industrial complex on the board of directors, mind you. I mean, this was like, there's a guy named, just check his name again, because I always seem to mispronounce his name, but Thomas Townsend Brown was the guy who started NICAP, but he had a deep and very highly intimate relationship with the United States Navy throughout his career. But then a gentleman by the name of Donald Kehoe, who's a retired Marine major, took control of the board, along with a gentleman from the a rear admiral from the United States Navy called Delmer Farney. So you had this organization that was a very influential organization and took this topic very seriously, that was staffed with high-ranking military personnel, including a vice admiral by the name of Roscoe Hillencoder. And, you know, he was well-known as a UFO skeptic, but he chose to you know, serve on the board of the governors of this organization. And then another interesting personage that we should go into some detail on is a gentleman by the name of Rear Admiral Herbert Bain Knowles, no relation, by the way, who was involved in a number of very interesting cases, including the Betty and Barney Hill case. I mean, he was actually a neighbor of the Hills. He was, yeah. So, and another neighbor of his was one of the first UFO channelers, woman by the name of Frances Swan, who had claimed to channel an alien intelligence called AFA. And AFA was a very interesting case study. But so we had a lot of people in the Navy, and the admirals, the Admiralty in particular, were very interested in this topic. Now, I've heard a lot of different explanations for this. I mean, there would be like sort of the skeptical explanation that this is all part of disinformation, that this is all psychological operations and so on and so forth. And then on the opposite end of that spectrum, we would say, well, you know, the Navy had a lot of experience with UFOs, but in particularly USOs, unidentified submersible objects. So there's a great range of opinion, but the one thing that is clear is that the Navy, in contradistinction to the Air Force, is that it's really the Navy who's taken the lead on this process. It's actually rather remarkable. And again, opinions differ on why exactly this is, but you know, what can't be argued with is the amount of interest that the branch of the service has taken. And
Has the Air Force been like in denial that they're there? I mean, is there this competition between the two forces?
Well, the Air Force, so the Navy really took the lead in the late 40s. And the Navy sort of jumped on this project. But with the creation of the Air Force, since these were flying objects, right? I mean, objects that are seen in the sky, that the onus was sort of put on the Air Force. And, you know, the Air Force was kind of sexy, too. It was like new and, you know,
right.
It was seen to be more glamorous and so on. You know, like Navy is like so old school. You know, it's like now we've got these planes and these jets, and you know, they sort of had that patina of.
Yeah, I thought the glamour. Air Force was more powerful than the Navy because it has that mystique.
Yeah, well, it did. It doesn't so much anymore, which is really interesting. You know, I sort of keep an eye on these things, and the Air Force seems to be like rather quiet. And like I said, the Navy has their own Air Force, which is rather considerable. The Navy has a very large Air Force because the Navy has aircraft carriers and super carriers. So very interesting. Now, see, but this gets into the whole public relations aspect of this because I don't know if you remember the show The Outer Limits. Do you remember that program?
Right.
So the guy who created The Outer Limits was a gentleman called Leslie Stevens, who was actually Army intelligence. But his father was a very powerful admiral who was the guy who created the gear that allows jet planes to land on aircraft carriers. It's a certain kind of arresting gear. You know, if you've ever seen those commercials or movies or something, those sort of metal wires and clamps and all these sort of things that stop
the plane. Catches it so it doesn't go off the edge of the craft.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So here's the interesting thing, and this is where we get into this whole other topic of conversation here. So the guy who invented that, his son created what was really the first major UFO television program called The Outer Limits. Now, here's the interesting thing about The Outer Limits is that it arguably took a lot of cases that had been classified, abduction cases and so on, that had been classified and sort of allegorized them for this series. Mm-hmm. But one thing that I've spoken to Richard about at length, and one thing that I've detailed at length on the blog, is that I believe this Leslie Stevens was the original driving force for Star Trek. That I think that Gene Roddenberry, because it's one thing that I discovered, and I discovered almost by accident, is that Gene Roddenberry was basically set up in office with Leslie Stevens while he was developing Star Trek. And a lot of people, who worked on The Outer Limits, who were Leslie Stevens' people, ended up working on Star Trek. You know, people like William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and on and on and on. Robert Justman. I mean, a number of people who are well known today as being part of that show, Star Trek, the original series, got their start working for Leslie Stevens, who, again, was the son of a very powerful and almost... almost mythological kind of character, because he was involved with the Joint Chief of Staff, and he was also involved in debriefing Russian defectors. I mean, a very impressive gentleman with an incredible resume. And of course, again, he was an inventor and basically invented the gear that allowed the United States Navy to take control of the entire planet.
Right. And if they were sharing an office, I mean, obviously he had an impact on... obviously he did.
Well, I'll tell you something. There's a gentleman who was involved in the original Star Trek, a guy named Herbert Solo, and he's been very cagey about that. But he came out and said that that a friend of his, quote unquote, was actually the real creator of Star Trek. And one thing that transpired when I read Herbert Solo's book is that one of his best friends was Leslie Stevens, of course, from the Outer Limits and so on. So, yeah, I think that it's very interesting that, especially when you look at Star Trek, I mean, Star Trek is basically the Navy. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, Star Trek is basically, it's Starfleet, right? It's a fleet.
Right.
They're on ships. I mean, they follow... naval protocol, don't they? And one of the things that I noticed, particularly when the Star Trek motion pictures started to become popular in the 80s, is that whenever they showed the Federation Council, the Federation, Federation of Planets, which is like the United Nations or whatever, it seemed to be suspiciously overpopulated with Starfleet admirals in their red dress uniform. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the pictures that I included.
Yeah, number four.
Yeah, so okay. I have come to believe, given the provenance of people involved in that program, that I believe that Star Trek was essentially a project of, if not necessarily naval intelligence, then people who were associated with it. I think that there's a very powerful aura of naval intelligence behind that series, and up until the present moment. I mean, because there is a Star Trek program on the air as we speak, Star Trek Discovery, which Richard and I discussed, we found to be rather shockingly militaristic. So I wonder if that's part of upping the ante, so to speak. But also, when you think about UFO, particularly UFO religion, I guess, in this regard, L. Ron Hubbard, who was behind Scientology, was also U.S. Navy. And some have speculated and, believe very firmly that Hubbard was naval intelligence, was ONI, because, he had that very famous... relationship with Jack Parsons, the rocket scientist who's credited with inventing solid rocket fuel. And, everybody sort of looked askance at that because Hubbard is a very famous, Parsons is a famous occultist, dabbled in Satanism, was very close with Aleister Crowley, called Crowley his father. That's how we referred to him. They had a correspondence going. Hubbard later claimed, when pressed about his relationship with Parsons, said that, I was there to break up this Lima cult on behalf of naval intelligence. And everybody thought that's just, Hubbard blowing smoke again. But there are some credible people who believe that he was telling the truth, that he was actually there to on behalf of naval intelligence, because the obvious interest in rockets, and of course, this is the end of World War II, when you had people like Wernher von Braun and the Peenemünde people, you know, behind the V-2 rockets, taken into the United States. Now, the interesting thing about that, is, and this is a fact that not a lot of people realize, is that that was also a Navy operation, or Project Paperclip, Operation Paperclip. You know, the whole project of importing all these very prominent Nazi and German scientists, including von Braun and people like that, that was a Navy operation. And I know exactly where they were flown into. They were flown into the Naval Air Base in Squantum, Massachusetts, which was not far from where I was, you know, living as a child. I know that area very well. And they were also housed on Fort Strong, which is right off the coast of Squantum. And so it's very interesting because this is all Navy. Again, this is all Navy. And actually, there was a Naval Air Station on the other side of you know, where I was living at the time. So the Navy was you know, very prominent in that regard. So I think the Navy is very interesting because they do tend to, you know, they don't have that glamour, like, again, that you said that the Air Force would have, or now that Space Force has. But I think that the Navy is, I think they basically, you know, they run the world economy. By default, because without the United States Navy policing the shipping lanes, they would be overrun by piracy.
Oh, good point. Good point. So I'm curious, you mentioned that you lived near this place when you were a child. As a child, were you like getting vibes from it? Were you interested in this kind of topic? Did it?
Oh, do you want to open a can of worms or what? I mean, what's going on? Well, I'll tell you. Very interesting that you should ask that because, again, my parents, just before I was born, lived in Wollaston, which is near Squantum. Now, but here's the interesting thing again, because it gets back to this whole concept of ritualism that I think that is this, you know, I've spoken at length with Richard about ritualism, and I think it's so poorly understood. And, you know, you sort of have a sense of like mystification about it without people really understanding how central ritualism is to the operation of the world. And how ordinary ritualism is in so many regards. But in this sense, so you had von Braun and his group flown into Squantum, you know, the Naval Air Force Base there. And at the other end of what's used to be called Wollaston Boulevard when I was a kid, now called Quincy Shore Boulevard, it's like literally at the other end, you know, so this road, this boulevard, has two ends, and one end would be where Paperclip was flown in, and the other end is a part of Quincy called Marymount, and Marymount is where the first large-scale pagan, European pagan celebrations were held. Very famous episode in American history, colonial history. A gentleman by the name of Thomas Morton had started a sort of a rebel settlement in Marymount that the pilgrims all called Mount Dagon, and scandalized the Puritans because he held a May Day celebration there, and he invited the all the local Indian tribes to come in and join in. Yes.
We're going to need to hold it. We're at the top of the hour. You're listening to The Other Side of Midnight. Our guest tonight is Christopher Loring Knowles, and we shall return after the break.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.